Welcome to this week's I Drink Beer podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I read drink about books podcast. Let's do it. Join, you're in charge. Welcome to another episode of the I Read Comic Books podcast. My name is Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg, and this week I am joined by Nick White.
Hey.
And Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me this week, guys. How has comic books been? I know I asked you that last week, and it was kind of weird. I know, Paul, you still like comic books, but how has your week in comic books been?
I wrapped up Batman Eternal. I think last week I said that I was nearing the end and was sort of anxious to see how that wrapped up, and I'm actually happy to say that, you know, when I thought I had encountered all of the different twists this book had to offer, they pull one more at the end. I don't think it was enough to really make me, it wasn't like a good M. Night Shyamalan twist where it's like, oh, pure genius, and then you go back and you rewatch the whole thing and you're like, oh my gosh, well, this happened, and I wasn't looking for this, and I wasn't looking for this, and everything was clearly carefully calculated, and it all adds up. That's not it, but in terms of tapping into, without revealing too much for Paul here, because it taps into some of the mythology that Scott Snyder has created in the past, and I think that was really nice, and I'm not going to spoil too much here, but Talon makes a cameo appearance, and I was super happy about that. I can say that because it's not a big part. It's more like a touch, and Tinian wrote the article. Tinian wrote the final issue, which I thought was kind of interesting that it wasn't actually Scott Snyder. Yeah. I thought that was kind of weird. I thought they were going to bookend it and have Snyder come back and at the very least maybe write the last two or three, maybe write at least the final issue, but the final arc was all Tinian, which, I mean, maybe there's a certain amount of trust there between the two of them. Clearly they've worked together so much. So, you know, I was pleasantly surprised.
Cool.
Yeah.
How about you, Paul?
I've been rereading a lot of stuff, which is kind of interesting to go back and reread stuff. I was rereading All-Star Superman for probably the 20th time. and I stopped in the middle, took a break, and read Nameless number 3. And the disparity between those two books is stunning. You have the most optimistic, positive Superman story maybe ever. And then you have this dark, nihilistic issue, Nameless number 3, the last page of which chilled me to my core. I hope Chris Burnham and Nathan Fairbairn got paid extra for having to draw and color that horrific scene. So if you haven't read it yet, be warned. So comics. I still like them and I still read them.
Cool. Yeah, no, comics has been pretty good for me too. I'll say I've mostly been catching up and things like that. I purchased a copy of Transformers vs. G.I. Joes.
Yay!
Which I'm real excited about. I read the first issue of that, or part of an issue, or something like that. I basically got into it, and then I decided I wanted to watch the first episode of Daredevil. So, but comic books have been good. I'm really excited. All of my digital pulls have just been stacking up and stacking up. And so I've just kind of been catching up on those. But speaking of comics, as we always do, let's talk about our comic picks for the week. And Nick, let's hear your first pick for the week, or your pick for the week, I should say. You are first in picks for the week.
I am the first to pick, but I only have one pick.
Yes.
And
yes.
So should everybody, unless you're trying to break the rules, which we don't advocate.
Paul's a renegade, though.
Paul did it. Paul did it. Let me just say, George did it. He's never come back. Okay? Paul, you got lucky, apparently. Interestingly enough, I think my pick would have been your guys' pick. It must be a really really light week. I'm certain probably you and I, Paul, not getting into Convergence probably had something to do with this.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. You not getting into Secret Wars. I don't know if that has it started yet. Maybe not.
Ish. Maybe it's just a lot of week books in general. Yeah, a lot of books are wrapping up this week. So
yeah, so I went
this
with...
This month, I should say.
Yeah. So I went with Bloodshot Reborn, which is written by Jeff Lemire, and I want to say it's... I think it's Miko Suyalan or it's something like that. I knew I was gonna butcher it regardless. On art, and it's yes, technically we have had Bloodshot before. Bloodshot was rebooted. It wasn't one of the launch titles for Valiant in 2012, but it was definitely, I think, within about a half year of that. And of course, Bloodshot's always been known as more of their action-y title, more of guns, blood, violence, murder, killing, just invincible killing machines sort of stuff.
As long as he gets that protein.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. As long as he gets the protein to regenerate the requisite parts of his body, give me a chicken dinner. I don't think he talks like that. But yeah, what's like, interesting
give
is,
me a chicken parm, and yeah, I'll be fine.
Whoa. Yeah, he's got a real goofy
Yo,
voice.
Yo, Adrian! Right? That wasn't even Sylvester Stallone. That was that was someone else doing Sylvester Stallone.
You.
And then
doing
me impersonating that person impersonating Sylvester Stallone, all of which were done poorly. That being said... it's interesting because Bloodshot technically ended a while ago, and so instead of simply just making this what I think would be Bloodshot 27, they're calling it Bloodshot Reborn, and again, it's one of those Valiant titles where they're actually, things are building upon their world events, and in, I don't want to spoil too much, I'll try to keep it vague, because I think the Valiant only wrapped maybe about a week or two ago, so I realize I should keep this a little bit, spoiler warning, but, certain things happen at the end of the Valiant that bring about large changes for Bloodshot, or at least they're hinted at. I don't want to get at it any more than that. They've been playing the cards pretty close to their chest, and a lot of the previews for Bloodshot Reborn, they haven't definitively answered whether what happens, what we think happens at the end of the Valiant actually comes about or not. But Jeff Lemire has said in a couple interviews and whatnot that this is not going to be sort of the nonstop violence that we got with I'm going to butcher his name too, but was it like, is it Dwayne or Dwayne Szwirinski's run, which again, I like that run. It was fun. It was definitely, you know, very much an action movie sort of thing, but this is actually going to be sort of a more psychological exploration of violence and the consequences of such and how we deal with these things and coping mechanisms and sort of the big picture of that. So, and that's very much in Lemire's wheelhouse. So you know, it's sort of his thing, personal, emotional, psychological tales. I'm really interested to see where it goes, and I'm a little nervous now that he signed the Marvel exclusivity contract that might endanger this, but we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, strangely enough, as Nick said before, Paul and I have the same pick this week, which is the Fade Out number 5. So, Paul, do you want to talk about this book this week?
Yeah, I guess I will. Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips doing Fade Out. This might be my favorite book that they've done together, as much as I love Criminal.
Really?
I just think, like, the setting of this book, if you haven't read it yet or if you haven't checked it out, it's set in the late 40s in Hollywood, so right after World War II. You have the sort of blacklist in Hollywood where filmmakers are suspected to be communists. People have been called out and blackballed. And
names were named.
Lives were ruined. And then you have the sort of murder mystery on top of this. This screenwriter finds a dead woman in his apartment and has to figure out what happened to her. And she was a lead actress of the film that he's working on. It's a great setup. I love that sort of setting. It gives it a very specific time and place and feel.
Also allows for some liberal uses of phrases and ideas that we don't really see in modern comic books, television, movies, all that.
Yeah. I mean, Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips have mastered this sort of murder mystery, sort of dark film, not film noir, but crime noir sort of, you know, story. Criminal was, because it was set in more modern times, had for a grittiness to it. Fade Out has that same grittiness, but it's like you said, it's a different setting, so it gives it a different feel. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what I like about it.
The thing about the Fade Out, though, that's so great is that it's not about a detective.
Right.
It's not about someone who's actively like good at solving crime or is it any involvement in crime, really. Yeah. I mean, it's about this guy who's a screenwriter and happens to find this dead woman and he's like, what do I do other than keep it a secret? Because this is Hollywood and they'll fucking kill you for this shit. Yep. Like,
right.
It's such an interesting twist on the standard story style that that Brubaker and Phillips have come to like own, really, at Image.
Yeah.
As far as my take on it, like these guys are absolutely killing it. I feel like there's a lot of I run into a couple issues with like Phillips' art. A lot of his characters are drawn the same, and this is kind of a problem I've had with a lot of his books.
You've read a lot of his stuff. I'm sure your fatigue for his art is probably...
And it's not that I dislike it. It's still very beautiful
the
art.
The color work is fantastic.
Yeah, well, and that's Elizabeth Breitweiser. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I nominated her for Best Colors of the Year, and I love Jordi Belair, and I think Breitweiser is doing a much better job. Yeah. But anyways, I think, you know, Sean Phillips' art is kind of repetitive in a way, and as much as that is sometimes kind of takes me out of the comic, I at least know what to expect. I at least know that he can draw someone, draw things, draw everything that they're working with, like, very well. But at times it's a little distracting. Like, I go, I get some people confused because they have similar face shapes, or I'll, you know, misplace remembering the story in my head. I go, was that Criminal or was that this book, you know? But on the whole, like, I think that this story is very well executed. I think Ed Brubaker loves the past. He loves writing in these settings, 40s, 50s, 60s. And, like, with this series, it's right on the nose. It's right in his wheelhouse. And the back matter in these issues is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. He knows his, like, stuff. If you want proof, just read the back.
Holy cow. It's, and he knows people that know their stuff. Exactly, like, if these are the people that he's talking to for research on this book, like, it's obvious that he's not just writing a story. He is doing his research and trying to write an epic, you know, for lack of a better word. But I really think that's what it is. Just like Criminal, just like, what was it, Incognito? Did he do that? Yeah, like, those two books, even, I think it was, did he do Sleeper or was that with someone else? Yeah, and Sleeper as well. Yeah. Like, you know, all these books, like, he's definitely done a lot of research and wants to tell an incredible story that is not only, like, accurate to the times, but also just a well-developed story on the whole. And, I mean, that, you know, any writer could potentially do that, but the fact that Brubaker can bring these two elements together so well makes him a very standout artist. And the fact that he can do anything that he wants with Sean Phillips at Image after their five-year agreement that they made last year, like, oh my gosh. There's so much fun stuff.
It's very interesting to see two creators that have worked so well together in the past and know each other's style so well. It's almost like it's like one unit. I don't think of them as two separate creators. It's like, you know, when Brubaker Phillips, it's like it's one thing. Yeah. You know exactly what you're getting because they know each other so well and they collaborate, obviously, so closely on making this world work.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you pair Brubaker with another artist, I would think of them as a separate entity. Like, it would be a different writing style, it'd be a different feel for the whole book, but with Phillips and Brubaker together, like, it is, like you said, it's a complete package. Like, that's one creative thing, rather than two people coming together to work on the same piece of art. And, yeah, Fade Out's real good. Like, I mean, we talked about it, I feel like, a handful of times.
Yeah.
It's a book I recommend to anyone who's looking to get away from superhero genre, looking for a good crime story. Like, if I'm not recommending Criminal, I'm recommending this.
Yep. And even if you feel maybe like you're fed up with the whole crime noir thing, I feel like this is a real... I think what's made those two survive, despite doing a lot of very seemingly similar stuff a lot of the time, is that they've always managed to create just a little nuance in each story allows it to be separated from a lot of their other material that might seem, you know, superficially similar or obviously have a very similar art style. They're always finding a little nuance. Fatale obviously carved itself out a little, spot. But I like that this doesn't have that typical detective trajectory where it's like, I'm gonna solve this mystery. I gotta, you know, this person came to me and needs help, and I'm gonna get, you know, I'm gonna find evidence, and I'm gonna get clues, and I'm gonna figure out who did it. It's just, you have this guy who doesn't know what to do with himself, and, you know, is just more concerned about his own well-being than anything. And I think that's what's fascinating, is I don't know where this book is going to go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know what the trajectory of this book is. I don't know where the point is or who's... No one's trying to fix something or solve something or, you know, figure out something. It's just this, you know, massive unraveling of secrets, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And it's set in Hollywood at this time. Like, it's a world just filled with secrets. I mean, they're in the business of making stories and, you know, creating this fictional world. And it's almost like it's creeping into their daily lives. It's like they have to put up this facade and be different. To be different people than they really are inside. So
Especially with some of the most latest reveals in the last two issues in specific. Like, not to spoil, I don't want to spoil it, but like the reveals that they gave totally like takes to what you were just saying, Paul. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much. Like, Brubaker's building a very like massive amount of like very deep characters like that have a lot of history. And like you said, with Hollywood and things like that, it's just. It's so well crafted. It's so well put together. I really enjoyed this book.
Great.
So that being said, we're gonna take a quick break, eat some Chinese food, and we will get back to this somewhat special episode of I Read Comic Books. I don't think I said that at the beginning of the show. this week, Nick is in town. We actually did a series of in-house recordings with a bunch of the other staff at Destroy the Cyborg. So look for those in the near future when we have off weeks or when we decide to not release a regular episode. But this one's great because Nick's here and Paul's here and I'm here. And Jordan's here, even though he's in the background. Yeah. So,
but he is here nonetheless.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and we will be back to discuss some topics. So sounds catch you in cool. a minute.
All right.
So I don't know if you guys have seen this. It's not hard to miss because it's about 5 pages long. But Marvel recently announced that leading into Star Wars Episode 7, they're going to release an original graphic novel. It's got a great title. It's got a great writer, Greg Rucka. But let me touch on that title for you guys. It's going to be called Star Wars: Journey to Star Wars: The Force Awakens - Shattered Empire.
Is this supposed to be a trade that, like, ignoring the title, first off,
is
this supposed to be a trade?
If you can,
That links 6 to 7?
Well, we know that it's going to be it's going to lead into 7. It'll have some of the material going up to 7, but I don't really know if we're going to get a super detailed 6 to 7 sort of thing where it's like, here's what happened over 25 mm-hmm. years, or if we're maybe just going to get like a little bit of a prologue of sorts, but not like a here's extensively what happened over this time period. We really don't know much more at this point. There was some preliminary artwork released. It was by Phil Noto, who of course is fantastic, Black Widow, but they haven't said whether or not he's actually going to be doing the interiors, which is sort of weird because clearly by this point, with this coming out in November, like,
should have that.
Someone's assigned to this book.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird. I don't know what's going on there.
But that title.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Run that by me one more time. Yeah. Do we have time?
I think so. We can fit it in.
Yeah. Star Wars: Journey to Star Wars: The Force Awakens - Shattered Empire. I think my favorite part is just Star Wars: Journey to Star Wars. I think that's.
Star Wars: Journey to Star Wars. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Well, it's one of those things that, like, it looks weird on print. But, like, probably looks okay on an actual cover because it'll have
the big, bold Star Wars and then under it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But, as
but
far
still.
As, yeah. Like, that's such a ridiculous title.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's making absolutely sure people know that it's Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
And just, if you weren't sure, Star Wars.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and Marvel is seriously banking on these Star Wars comics, though. Like, right?
Yeah. They released some figures, and they said for the month of March, 4 of the top 10 selling books were Star Wars books.
And
for Marvel, yeah. And the most interesting thing, if I remember this correctly, was that two of them were actually Princess Leia issues.
Oh, that makes sense. So that book is awesome.
So it wasn't that new one, the whatever Last Jedi or whatever, making up the fourth. It was actually two Leia issues. And you're totally right. That was four of the top 10. They said that hasn't happened since 1977, which I'm sure Paul knows what that means. I don't know if you know what that means.
He's not that old. Jesus
not that old.
No, because of the significance of the year 77.
Yeah,
You know what that means. You don't know because you don't know Star Wars. That's what I was
this. Oh, at. This is absolutely true. This is absolutely
77
true.
Was the year Star Wars came out.
Exactly.
Episode 4.
Okay. I actually didn't know that. So thanks. I just assume everything in the 70s happened in 1975.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Or 79. That's it. There is nothing else that happened.
Nothing else. Yeah. Period.
Like disco every day, 1975.
John Travolta.
John Travolta born Greece. 1975.
Uh-oh.
He was born a full 21-year-old adult in 1975.
Fully formed out of the womb.
Sorry.
I think that's really interesting because obviously Marvel and Star Wars have this long history together. It's kind of cool to see him back, you know, doing this. But at the same time, I'm very cynical because it's not really Marvel and Star Wars. It's Disney owning both of them.
Yeah.
Sort of forcing this corporate synergy, you know.
Right, exactly. And I think another thing that I found kind of interesting, and I hope I'm not wrong on this. I was sort of very briefly reading it yesterday or something. To my understanding, Marvel has the ability and the rights to actually republish any of the Dark Horse stuff.
Yeah, they are. They are.
Interesting. Yeah, okay, fascinating.
Yeah. They're publishing like ultimate omnibus editions of old Star Wars stuff from the Marvel original run, as well as early Dark Horse run, from my understanding.
Huh.
Yeah.
So interesting.
It's interesting. I don't know. We'll see how that goes, but... clearly it's a feather in their cap. I don't know if we could have ever predicted it was going to be doing this well. I mean, sure, most of these Star Wars comics are only on issue 3 or 4 at this point, but
they're obviously still going strong. Like, which I know that when it first came out, we were all like, oh, a million copies. Well, that's going to drop off. Yeah. And it did. It did drop off significantly, but to what? 200,000?
Yeah, which is still, geez.
Still great.
Yeah.
200 is still like, what? That's like 4 or 5 times what Batman. I think Batman's somewhere around 40, I think. 40
probably,
or 50.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it's still amazing. And it sort of makes you wonder if you're like DC Comics and you're staring at the fact that Marvel now has 9 of the top 10. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, before that, maybe DC only had 2. With probably Justice League and Batman, but still, you know, Marvel has the top 10. Their books are selling like crazy. These Star Wars books are doing great. Like, what's your answer to that?
Well,
or
yeah,
do you not even care?
Wasn't Marvel? Marvel had not only the top 4 or 5 slots, but also the top 9 slots, right?
Right. So the deal was that 4 of the top 10 were Star Wars books.
Yeah.
9 of the top 10 are Marvel books, and I think.
Man.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what the 10th was?
I think the only one that was not was, I want to say it was the Multiversity issue for that month.
Yeah.
It wasn't Batman, and to its credit, and this is one thing that's worth mentioning, Batman 40 got delayed.
Right.
So 40 got delayed to next month, so of course that wasn't able to really factor into this.
But. Gotcha.
Right.
But
nonetheless, DC the primary competitor? Like, what are they going to do to this? Like, what licenses can they throw in our faces to try to get people to buy comics, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And you have to feel like whatever their strategy is, we probably haven't seen it yet because they were probably waiting to see for a couple months how Marvel was going to, or how these books were going to be received. So right about now, they're probably asking the exact same questions we are. Like, can you do anything? I mean, I think overall, the last couple of years, Marvel has been ruling the market anyway.
Yeah, at least 60% or more. Well, not whole market share, but in terms of like top 10, they've usually had the top 4 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then of course you introduce Star Wars and you pull that whole nostalgia thing, and you get people coming out to buy comic books that haven't probably purchased comic books either ever or in the last 15, 20 years. Like, just to say, new Star Wars, new everything, let's wipe the slate clean and get some fresh Star Wars stuff that's going to be closer to the continuity, you know?
Exactly.
Especially
and that's
for
the
hardcore
biggest thing.
Star Wars fans, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the material you're getting now is going to, it's building or it's part of the new Star Wars canon. And I think that appeals to people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of Star Wars fans, after all of the expanded or extended, whichever one it is, I think it's Expanded Universe, got jettisoned, I'm sure they were like, well, you know, what am I even supposed to go to?
What
now?
Is my life now?
Yeah, like, give me direction, please. Yeah. And then J.J. Abrams appeared out of the clouds, you know, and promised the mystery box. And then the fans went, oh, but it's probably Khan. And then he said, no, it's not Khan. And then a few months later, they found out it was Khan, and things got awkward.
This is Star Trek, though.
Yeah,
what are we?
And let's not forget, J.J. Abrams is now running Star Wars and Star
this
Trek.
This is true.
Which is also kind of alarming, and I don't know if we want to touch on that now, but I do think that's kind of weird.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
No, I actually have no problem talking about that.
Okay.
Because how does one person
end
up sitting in those two camps at the same time? Like, I thought that was like a red and blue type of thing. Like, that was a Marvel DC thing. That's a Coke Pepsi thing. Like,
exactly.
You don't get the best of both worlds. You have to pick one. And not to say that you... Whatever. You understand the implication, though. Like, if you're a Marvel person, you're a Marvel person. If you're DC, you're DC. I don't care if you read both books from both worlds.
You have a preference.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And how J.J. Abrams finagled his way into this, like, he must have seriously, like, given a child away for that. Like, no joke. Or something.
He probably revealed the true ending to Lost or some bullshit. I don't know. It's weird. And it's like, I think a lot of us feel that, like, I'm just uncomfortable with it. I think J.J. is very, very flash and no substance. I think, as I was telling a friend a couple days ago, the reason I feel okay about him on this is that I know that this movie, if you want to put it on a 10% scale, it'll probably be no lower than a 6, but I don't think it'll be any higher than an 8. I don't think it's going to be super inspired. JJ only makes me all right with the notion that I don't think it's going to be a bomb. I don't think,
with the
production values and whatnot.
I'm curious, because you really have Star Trek, which seems to be geared toward being rebooted in different takes on the same material.
Oh, sure.
Versus Star Wars, which is developed and established mythology that he's drawing on.
And it's clearly the more accessible of the two.
That's super bizarre. I don't know. I can't even say anything more than what I've already said. But
like, how about this? Think of that. Disney basically owns your childhood, because they have Star Wars, Marvel, The Muppets, Disney.
Welcome to my whole life, man.
They've got all of it.
I've given in to the two corporate entities of my choice, and they are Disney and Apple. Like,
they own you.
Yeah, right? that's pretty much it. If you pulled the plug on one of those, that would be me. I'd be dead. That's it, you know?
That being said, Mike Rappin is in the looking for an Apple Watch, and if any of you are listening want to donate to his cause,
If you want to donate an Apple Watch, I'll gladly take it, but...
I mean, he's saying he's rolling his eyes right now, and he's like, I would never wear one of those, but for free, I'm certain.
Yeah, I definitely would keep it as an item. I wouldn't wear it. I'd put it in my pocket and hide it with shame.
The Apple Pocket Watch that's coming, I think, next year.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's kind of funny when you think about it is at least when like people were having their phones stolen, at least if you put it in your pocket and someone running up to mug you wouldn't at least know for certain whether or not you had one. The Apple Watch at least makes that one step, you know, easier.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of like hand removal or wrist removals like in the future.
You know,
people come up with saws just to cut your whole arm off.
You know, pickpocketing, it's going to come back now. I mean, really, you know, the little tricks and whatnot. So...
to somehow reel it back to comic books, as we all take a long sip of our beers.
Yeah.
Do you think that this severe growth in Star Wars sales may have an effect on the Marvel sales on the whole? I mean, obviously, there's Marvel selling, you know, the majority of comic books, but we said that the top 9 of 10 comic books that were purchased in March. Were Marvel. Do you think that that's a direct relation because of the number of Star Wars books sold, then said made people realize, oh, I could also buy this book that was advertised in this book? Do you think that that's probably repercussion? I mean, more than a yes or no answer would be.
sure. You know? Absolutely. Well, I would say, there probably are some people going out, haven't bought comics before, ever, or are coming back, or are switching over to Marvel because they were previously with Dark Horse, and now Star Wars is in their camp. And yeah, I don't know how many people that really like Luke Skywalker or Yoda are gonna, you know, find a new friend in Wolverine or Storm.
That's what Secret Wars is about, right?
Yeah. It's a team up. It's a crossover. Make it happen. But like we talked about before, if they can even get 10% of those people to pick up one of their like Marvel books, or I don't really want to call them Marvel, X-Men/...
Avengers, anything.
I guess when I say Marvel book, I exclude the Star Wars books. I'm sure that's
what I agree.
If they can even get 10%, this is going to work great for them. I mean, if they can compound their sales even further.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a pretty smart marketing move on their point. Because I know that the first issue of Star Wars was included in the Loot Crate. So people that subscribe to that Loot Crate thing, they got the first issue with the variant cover. A lot of people probably aren't exclusive comic fans that get that. So it's that's great advertising for Marvel. And basically... the ads in Marvel books are just for other Marvel books. They don't really advertise for anything else.
Oh, no, except for the Spider-Man underwear ads. That's right. Spider-Man, no joke, Spider-Man underwear, Spider-Man bedspread in the middle of an Avengers book where thousands of people are dying.
Let's take a break here. And,
I'm 27, almost. You know, I could definitely use Spider-Man bedspread. Huh? Like you never see any ads in Marvel books for other things other than their books, except for those action occasional weird ads or like the Adam Kubert School of Art.
Exactly.
And that's it. Yep. But Spider-Man underwear and bedspread, like
Wolverine just chopped that guy in the head. Let's talk about your premium bedding options,
right? Like, who is their demographic in those ads? I don't understand that.
So you're 6.
So you're 6, and you're reading about the destruction of the multiverse. Do you understand that concept?
Did it just make you piss your pants? If so, Here's you need these print. Undergarments. They're reinforced.
No, so but the direct sales correlation, I think, is something that Marvel, like, there's obviously no way to necessarily track that, I think.
Right.
But at the same time, like, the data is there. Like, we can see that there's a correlation between the number of Star Wars books sold and the number of overall Marvel titles sold.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be curious to see if they did some sort of A-B testing or A-B-C-D testing in terms of ads. So, like, you know, they put a Miss Marvel ad in, like, the first 100, you know, or 20,000 Star Wars comics and then, Black Widow, so on and so forth, to try to diversify their advertising, like, budget or whatever. And then see, you know, okay, oh, look, Black Widow spiked because of this, or, you know, Captain America spiked because of this. Mm-hmm. Or was that just, like, a coincidence that Marvel's actually taking over in terms of sales on the whole, so...
And I would love to see the correlation between Loot Crate and Loot Crate's ability to actually get people to continue reading the book afterwards. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't want
to... Do, like, a survey almost to Loot Crate people to see how many of you continue to read Star Wars after getting it.
Right.
Or even, in general, any of the comics that they send out. I mean, going back to the episode where we did talk about Loot Crate and stuff, like...
Exactly, and that's where I was going is, I still want to know how things end up in Loot Crate. Maybe that's on their website.
It's got to be something that they
I would love to know how you get picked, or how people pick you.
Yeah. Because that could destroy, not destroy, I should say, that could, like, explode, I don't know another word, for, that could explode like an indie book. Like, imagine you are just some guy publishing a book through Dark Horse, and then they decide, we're going to pick, I always go to this, Pariah number one.
Right.
It's the only indie book I can think of. We're going to pick Pariah number one as our Loot Crate. Like, so that we're going to buy 100,000 copies of your book. And that's a creator-owned book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, the premiums off of that, like, there you go. I'm done. I did that. I did the thing now.
Right.
Now I'm an established creator, because not only did I make money, but, like, my name's out there to 100,000 people. Like, that's insane. So, to figure out that their algorithm or whatever creation process they have over at Loot Crate would just be fantastic.
I would love to know if you can, like, if you've got, like, if you're Marvel and you've got Secret Wars rolling along real soon, like, is there some way that you can go to Loot Crate and say, like, we want our number one of Secret Wars to be your book for whatever month?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to know if that's possible, or if Loot Crate is like, no, you don't call the shots, we pick things, because... Mm-hmm. The cynic in me says that is not how it is.
It's probably not how it is.
No,
yeah.
No, I guarantee you that it's Marvel or DC coming to them with a big book and saying, we're doing that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, what other stuff have they picked that's been in the Loot Crate at that large of an amount?
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, and that also begs the question of how many subscribers they have, or Loot Crate is, you know, supposedly garnishing, or, you know, how many comics, or how many Loot Crates go out with the same book in them? I mean, like, obviously with Star Wars, they probably put out the same thing. Same with Rocket Raccoon, probably put out the same thing. But, like, do they pick and choose based off of your preference or your package that you get? I mean, like, a lot of questions. They probably need to do a little bit of research on Loot Crate to discover.
I think that one is
fixed.
I think everybody does get the same per month.
Okay.
Everybody runs up with the same stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
The Star Wars thing, obviously a big deal. I think in a year. I think it'll be in a year, we'll actually be able to see how much of an effect and how important the Star Wars comic books are to not only Marvel, but to the fans.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm very cynical that any sort of movie or pop culture tie-in actually moves the needle as far as monthly sales for comics. I'm very cynical. I really don't think the people that are buying Star Wars comics are going to be buying more Marvel titles or will continue on very long. I really don't think that's true.
And it'll be interesting to see how these Star Wars books do when there isn't a movie on the horizon.
Exactly.
And more importantly, the big return of Star Wars on the horizon, which is what we're facing soon. Let's see what it's like when it's Star Wars movie every year like clockwork. Let's see what sort of reception we're getting then.
Exactly. So, have either of you started watching Daredevil on Netflix?
Not yet, Paul.
I watched one episode, and I feel so guilty. I feel like I should have watched... I should be done with it by now. It's Sunday. It is April 12th. I should be done with it. It premiered on Friday. I should be done, but alas, I am not.
Isn't that terrible that we live in, like, this culture where, like, this show rolls out, and you feel bad that the weekend isn't even completely done, and you have yet to have consumed all of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like getting a new trade, though. Like, when a new trade drops, like, when I bought Seconds, But, you know, Brian Lee O'Malley's Seconds, and I didn't finish it. I haven't even cracked it. Yeah. I bought that when it came out, like, 8 months ago or whatever, and I haven't even sat down and read it at all. Like, it's awful.
It'll probably make you sad, so, I mean.
Yeah, I expect
that.
I'm
thinking, maybe I'm thinking of, like, the Blankets author now.
I think something else. But no, Daredevil, I've seen an episode, but it was awesome. I mean, the first episode fucking sold me, as I expected it to.
Yeah, admittedly, I'm only two episodes in myself, and so far, I think it's fantastic. It might be, I know it's small sample size and too early to tell, but might be my favorite live-action adaptation that Marvel's done, including all the movies. I mean, I just think, as much as I enjoy my superheroes to be bright, sunshiny, and optimistic, Daredevil is a character that fits well in a gritty crime setting. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously borrowing pretty heavily from the Frank Miller and the Brian Michael Bendis runs, as opposed to the Mark Waid run, which is closer to my heart.
that series is just fantastic. Like, it's lighthearted, but it's still got a lot of crime to it, and it's still got a lot of Daredevil doing Daredevil stuff. But it's definitely on the lighthearted side of things.
And the show so far, unless it changes radically in the next few episodes, it's very much not lighthearted. I get the sense that Marvel might have made this a Netflix series just so they could make it R-rated without actually having an R-rated movie, because those don't sell well. I'll have to wait and see if that's the case. I mean, if it continues to be so violent. But watching the show and my reaction to it compared to the other Marvel movies, which I think are okay on average, it made me think, are superheroes, the genre and the characters in general, just better suited for serialized narratives, episodic storytelling, as opposed to feature films? I think they really are, because I've always preferred the animated shows and the TV shows, by and large, versus the movies. So, and that's the way we've consumed these characters for generations, is through comics and episodically. So, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have to sort of agree with you in some sense. It seems like with these movies that roll out, especially now, there's sort of an obligation for a much more bombastic narrative. You know, there has to be, you know, everything has to be big and the huge consequences and lots of characters and lots of villains. And, you know, you sort of have to get lost in just this massive amount of information and whatnot. And it seems like with the shows, there's an ability to have much more focused moments or focused episodes, or really, you know, look at one thing more specifically over another. Without that obligation of having to, you know, stuff it with a billion different things, which it seems like the modern superhero movie, like, if you don't have a bunch of villains and three or four sidekicks and, you know, one or two cameos for future movies and, you know, a scene after the credits, well then, you know, what's wrong with your movie?
Right.
So I really like that idea that it doesn't have to fulfill what I think is the superhero movie checklist these days.
Right, right. I mean, my example, I guess, where that the way that a feature film doesn't work for superheroes, the best example might be the Tim Burton Batman movie, which is a standalone story.
Which one? Okay. I'm kidding.
No,
where the Batmobile has guns, or the one where the Batmobile has guns?
The problem with the first movie, as much as I loved it when I was 7 years old, when I saw it, the problem is it had to be a complete story. So the fact that the character that becomes the Joker killed Batman's parents, ends up dying at the end, it's like a self-contained
everything story. Has to wrap up.
Everything wraps up at the end, and there's no reason for there to be a second movie. And Batman Returns is its own proof of that, because it's basically unwatchable.
Right.
Wait, no.
No.
Yes.
Danny DeVito? Are you fucking
kidding
me? When
he eats that fish?
That whole movie is like awful and amazing. Not in the same way you watch like a shitty B movie, but like everything about that movie is so grotesque, and it's absolutely perfect, and it's like disgustingness. Like, I want to throw up watching that movie, but I'm happy
to. I think
to.
Paul does too, but I don't think it's for the same thing.
Exactly. Okay, anyway, we're off topic.
Yeah. I mean, but that's what I'm getting at is the Marvel movies now, the last 20 minutes of each movie leads into the next movie. So they're making a serialized thing, but each one has to sort of stand on its own.
Right.
When you have a TV show, you can tease things out. You can play the long game. You can hint at things coming later on the road. The fact that The Flash is so good, I think hints at this idea that having an episodic narrative for these characters allows the mythology of the characters to be explored more deeply than you can have in just 90 minutes, you know, right. in a movie. So
where everything has to be, you know, concisely and cleanly wrapped up.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, that's a problem.
And I think that, like, I agree with you, Paul. I think that serialized television definitely does a much better job of establishing characters and, you know, allowing their mythos to grow and things like that. But I think the idea of these movies that we watch, like, you know, the idea of Captain America, of Thor, of Iron Man, I mean, even Chris Nolan's Batman, you know, movies, like, I think we kind of walked into those knowing a lot of the mythos already. Like, we walked into those going, we know who Captain America's gonna be, so they can just kind of breeze over the backstory for him. We can breeze over a lot of things to get to the central focus of the story, which is to stop the Red Skull, to, you know, stop the Russians, I don't know, I guess whatever, you know, to stop Ra's al Ghul, to, you know, to do all the, you know, to stop Loki, his brother, you know, like, all of these things, Russians was Iron Man too. Anyways, I think, you know, the point of those is, you know, to just tell a single story, and if it has a connection to another movie, that feels almost like tacked on. Like, it's like reading an OGN versus reading single issues, right? Yeah. Television is more closer to single issues, and it works so much better for the format, simply because we already know that format. We know the serialization of a character and know how that, you know, something will build over six issues or build over three issues. Whereas when you watch a movie, to me it feels like it's a contained story. It's like an annual. It's like maybe, like I said, a graphic novel where it's not that it's not related to the main story, but it is like a story of that character. So like the fact that you get a longer form version of that means that you're getting a special version of that story, you know?
Right.
And yes, to your point, Marvel is definitely trying to create a serialization of their movies, which to me is like almost, when you put it that way and you think about it that way, almost seems super, it's really, really flawed. Not that it seems flawed, it is flawed.
It is.
Only because of the amount of time between each movie. And you're not going, you can't really bank on the fact that people are going to go to these Marvel movie premieres where they watch all 14 movies right before Avengers 3 and 4, you know? You have to just assume that these people already kind of know the mythos and they just jump into the next story arc. And I mean, this kind of goes into a discussion about our culture in terms of movies as we see it right now, where we expect a trilogy, so we have to obsess.
Right.
Or even talking about Daredevil, where I can't believe I didn't watch the whole series over a weekend because you have to obsess in order to keep up with the times.
Yeah.
Right.
But I don't know.
Well, that's gotten kind of interesting too, because it seems like a lot of the news media and blogs and websites are sort of struggling with how to tackle or how to handle some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like I think like IGN has been slowly releasing episode reviews for each episode of Daredevil, like every day or so.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, you have to wonder, like, how do you handle that? Do you review it as one thing? Is it meant to be reviewed as one thing?
How long do you wait?
Space the reviews out? How long do you wait? Because of course that's based on how much do you, or what rate do you think the average viewer is actually consuming it at?
Well, I'm sure Netflix has those numbers.
I'm certain they do. But, you know, one other thing I think both of you are talking about, which is totally right about the difference between movie and TV, is you're talking about the unnecessary sequel, or how do you build the sequel. And that's what's great about TV, is because you always know that you're going to have another episode to do whatever you want next, other than, you know, maybe not being certain about the end of the season. But, of course, with movies, especially, like, if you want to talk about a perfect example, like Pirates of the Caribbean 1 is actually not a bad movie. It's a pretty good movie. But it was made without the intention of ever being a trilogy.
Right.
And so because of
quadrilogy.
Or being a quad. Septilogy. It's going to be five now. It's, exactly.
What is that? Is that
quintilogy?
Quintilogy. Yeah. Sorry, septilogy is seven. My bad.
Yeah, and so, you know, because of that, the quality of the subsequent volume suffers, because it's like, well, we didn't really plan on this, so we're going to have to make another small self-contained story, I guess.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see how this will play out, too, because when you're writing a TV show, traditionally in the past, you had it spaced out over time. Mm-hmm. Now it's designed to be consumed maybe in one go, right? So the writing has to change. How you structure each episode and how you structure the season is going to be radically different. Is Daredevil really an episodic story, or is it just a 13-hour movie like
segments.
Cut into, you know, 13 segments? It's going to change the way narratives are structured and told. We live in interesting times, you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's super interesting to see media that's now being engineered for this sort of consumption.
Yeah.
And how do you, I think it changes how people write. I think it changes how people sort of have an emphasis on, like, the ending of episodes, where it's like the goal is not, well, they'll be back here next week, so don't worry, but you know what? They're going to want to marathon this. You better have a hook or something that's going to keep them watching it.
Right.
And I think there's much more of a concern with hooking or you know, addicting people now than, well, you know, they'll just come back next week, you know, and they don't really have a choice because that's when the show is on and that's when they'll watch it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the key word right there, I think, is choice. Exactly. Right? Like, you have to write a show so that you don't give the user a choice to stop watching.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, when you look at, like, and I only say this because I am one of these sheeple people that, like, sits down and
I'm using what is that, Glenn Beck terminology?
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people that sits down and I watch House of Cards and I go, fuck, it's like a heroin addiction. It's like, if I stop watching this, like, some part of me is hurting, and I don't know why, and all I know is that House of Cards will fix that.
Netflix is like, you have 20 seconds to change your mind.
That countdown timer,
but we are going to give you, the illusion of choice.
Well, yeah, it's like, I open up my phone on my Chromecast, and I'm like, I could stop it, and my body's like purposely going slower, unlocking my phone. Uh-oh, the Wi-Fi didn't connect. I guess I'll sit here for another hour. You know, but like Daredevil's an example. Orange is the New Black, and you know,
oh my gosh, that show is so geared for.
But even you look at shows that aren't necessarily written for Netflix. Like, you look at a Black Mirror, for example, or Peaky Blinders, which you made me watch.
Yeah, haven't finished.
And you know, those shows aren't written.
Well, actually, Netflix, the Peaky was.
Oh, Peaky Blinders
was. I'm not
certain
if Peaky was Netflix helped to, not to draw too many lines here. I'm not certain if Peaky was Netflix helped publish, but then it was put out in the BBC, and then we took it in Netflix format over here. Otherwise, I think you might be right, and it's totally an exclusive. It's one of the two.
Either way, a lot of shows that you watch, like, compared to shows that are on, like, primetime, like NBC, CBS, you know,
broadcast TV.
Fox, yeah, broadcast television, you see, like, BBC shows have this similar format where they're, like, they have such a strong hook a lot of times at the end of episodes that you, want to watch more. Mm-hmm. Black Mirror as an anthology show, to me, has a strong hook only because I go, what the fuck kind of story could they potentially tell me next?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And that's why I marathon the shit out of that show, you know? Marco Polo being another example of a show that, like, is really hard to put down because there is such an expansive universe or world that they are playing in that I literally know nothing about. I know that Genghis Khan was someone.
Yeah.
Genghis, right?
That's how they say it in the show. Yeah.
I know that Genghis Khan was someone.
We watched the show. We know what we're saying. Yeah. Jeez.
I know that Genghis Khan was someone, but I don't really know anything other than the fact that he existed.
Right.
And so I want to know more because this is historical fiction and it's fantastic, you know? It's
And you know
it's
what?
Bizarre how television is being reformatted to watch. Because, like, when I sit down and watch an episode of House on Netflix, or I watch an episode of Bones or something like that on Hulu or whatever network television thing, I'm like, okay, I watched an episode. That's all I needed. That's my sandwich for the day.
No, like, I mean, on this point, not to interrupt.
Oh, no, no,
on this
go point, ahead, Paul.
If you watch the first season of Orange is the New Black versus the second season, the way they wrote the show is radically different. Because I realized people were just binge-watching it.
Yep.
The first episode, each episode sort of touched on each storyline. And you were sort of like, I have to see the next episode to see how this story continues.
Mm-hmm.
The second season, each episode was sort of basically focused on one character. So it stood alone a little bit more. I don't know if that was an attempt to slow down people from slow down the binge watching, or just them figuring out here's a different way we can write the show, knowing that we don't have to pace it out as much. So,
and you know, Mike, you actually brought up a really good point that I didn't even think about. I think there's like a real correlation between a lot of these Netflix exclusives we're seeing and like British television in terms of just the sheer amount of episodes being offered. It's usually a smaller number than American TV. I mean, like Daredevil is like 13, but some of the other ones have only been like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, BBC TV tends to hover around the 6 or 7 mark.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with BBC TV, like, you don't have like renewals or orders for the back order of episodes or anything like that. Or, you know, so we got the first half, now we're going to get the second half. You know what I mean? When shows get renewed or get ordered, you know, the BBC, you just have the episodes ordered for the season and then, you know, they get made. And I think with that method, I think that's why a lot of the time you see BBC TV generally being stronger. It's not as obligated to write filler issues or filler episodes or sort of pad it with a huge stable of writers. It's just one or two guys, and I think that that ultimately makes better programming. And maybe that's partially why Netflix TV or whatever has become so addictive, is because they're adopting this British model, I would say, of quality over quantity.
Yeah, you name me any Netflix show, and I'll tell you that the quality is greater than that of a primetime television show.
Yeah, I mean, let's put it out there right now. Can we think of a Netflix dud or a bona fide dud?
Their first
dud?
Show that they did, Hemlock Grove?
Hemlock Grove, you could say it's crap, but it's on season 3, and I know people that watch it, and
really?
I don't always think that highly of some of those people, but it's on season 3.
Oh, so I thought it got canceled. Oh, no. Man. Oh, I thought Hemlock...
You're right in the reception.
I watched the,
you're
first,
right in the reviews.
The first episode, I couldn't even get through the first episode of Hemlock Grove. Hmm. I did not know they were on season 3. I know Famke Janssen jumped on that show.
She was on at the beginning. Yeah, from the
She was
in X-Men.
Yeah, yeah. To relate it back to comic books.
No. She was also in GoldenEye.
Yeah. But, no, I think, I mean, Daredevil as a model, as an example for serialized superhero television next to Arrow, next to Flash, I think, I've only seen the one episode, so I can't speak for the whole season. But even in terms of, like, comparing what I've seen to Arrow or to Flash, it seems like they're way more straightforward on Daredevil about the story that they're trying to tell.
Yep.
Whereas with Arrow and Flash and even Gotham, and I don't want to go into the whole intricacies of the terrible shit that's happening on Gotham, or the little bits and pieces I've seen in Constantine, they have to do a lot of filler because they got to fill that 24-episode season slot.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. Like, I don't understand why we're still on that model, because we see that the 13-episode slot seasons work so much better. People want Breaking Bad. They want Mad Men. They want Walking Dead. And they want Hannibal. There's a handful of other television shows that are out there that are only 13 episodes.
AMC is largely around that.
Yeah. I mean, Hannibal is NBC. But even then, they cut it short. But you look at the quality of that show versus anything else on their network. Anything.
Yeah.
You name me any other show, and that show has the highest quality, hands down. And it's a show that I absolutely adore because of its attention to detail as well as its production values.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And you don't get that a lot from primetime television.
Not over here. No, it's I think there's sort of an anxiety with American TV that if something works, it needs to keep working until it doesn't, because otherwise, maybe you want this show to run only 13 episodes. That's great. When the 13 run, you need to come up with another show that's going to fill out the other 13 episodes for the end of the season. And I can tell you, especially if you're like NBC, it's slim pickings at that point, you know. And for anyone's like, oh, you know, you hate NBC. Look, Conan O'Brien was doing this for years when he worked on NBC, long before I thought of it. So, you know, it's not a new thing.
But so, sorry, I'm trying to keep roping it back to Daredevil, and then I just get on my soapbox about television. But, do you guys think that I kind of brought this up before, do you think that the serialization of these shows works better simply because we're used to the format? Or is it because that the serialization just lends to the storytelling, this type of story, better compared to feature films?
Well, I mean, an analog or a parallel comparison we could make is the difference between the monthly ongoing Batman series, right?
Sure.
Which you can get caught up in, and there's an ongoing story that, versus a sort of standalone story. I mean, my example is
Long Halloween,
which I'm not a fan of, but I can see why people enjoy it, because it's got every villain you want to see. It's got every character you want to see. It's a standalone story.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big budget movie. It's just throw everything people want. They don't have to read the month to month series to get their Batman fix. Everything they'll possibly want to see of a Batman comic is here in one package.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely
the difference between a serialized story and a standalone movie. And maybe it's a personal preference, but I just kind of prefer that serialized storytelling, because it allows you to explore themes and explore the mythology and explore the characterization a lot more deeply.
I mean,
than in a one-shot. Or,
I mean, it has the potential to be abused. I think we've all seen the serialized format get like filler issues, or you know, get hijacked by some event or something like that. Mm-hmm. So. But I totally agree.
But even straying from the big two, do you think that like OGNs, like from Image or from First Seconds. Let's take an example of a company that I know publishes original graphic novels that are always top notch. They do no single issues. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that format works better than, say, if they were to serialize those books, or say you have to make out 6 single issues, then we'll release the OGN?
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, you know, there might be the difference between established characters versus creator-owned characters. I know for First Second, they do the books that Paul Pope does.
Mm-hmm. Battling Boy.
Battling Boy. I thought that first standalone issue was fantastic, the OGN. I couldn't imagine it as an ongoing series. That's just the way Paul Pope writes. He writes these stories that are sort of self-contained and not serialized versus characters that are less tied to a specific creator and more like brands that lend themselves more to different interpretations and longer stories.
So. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. With something like First Second. Yeah. A lot of
I just want to throw a wrench
in this. With something like First Second, of course, a lot of the stuff you're getting from them is like slice of life or like memoir graphic novels.
Yeah.
I don't think you're ever going to see like a memoir graphic novel that really should or could be split into like a
I disagree.
Okay. Let's hear it.
Brian Wood's Local.
Oh, okay.
Brian Wood's what?
Local.
And what is that?
That is a series told in 12 parts.
Okay.
About one woman's travel across the United States.
Okay.
And it's like a memoir in the sense that she's remembering these stories, but like obviously the story's happening as the book's going on. But in the last issue, you kind of find out there's a little bit more of the story that's going on here. But even still, it's like a memoir type story, but it is told in single issue stories, and there are pieces of the story that continue on, and they feel like one shots. Like I could give you number 4, and you'd read it as a standalone; it would make sense.
Okay.
But also at the same time, as a complete serialized story, like if I was reading it when it was coming out, I think I would have been anxiously anticipating the next issue. But as a whole, you can go to a comic book shop and you can buy that local big hardcover graphic novel, and it probably reads like I sat down and read the whole series in like one go, and it reads like a long story rather than a series of singles. So I mean, I just want to be the devil's advocate here.
That's
so
fine. That's
but
fine. That's fine.
I think it works, but it does, like to Paul's point. It does kind of depend on how the story's written in the first place, too. Right. Like, you couldn't break up an original graphic novel into single issues without it feeling real cut up and edited poorly, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and there are stories that are designed to be self-contained that are published month to month. I mean, most people have read Watchmen in one sitting.
Yeah.
Most people, I mean, when it originally came out, the people that are reading it month to month, but I think the majority of people that have read Watchmen at this point have read it as a self-contained single volume.
Isn't it kind of funny how some of these books, like, we forget that they were ever released in single issues?
Exactly.
Like, some of these, they're so set in our minds as always being, like, for me, Long Halloween, I have to stop and think about it.
Yeah.
Like, that was released in single issues.
I can't even believe that. And, no joke. That makes no sense to me.
You know, the weirdest one is Black Hole by Charles Burns. That was single issues, which is crazy. And it took over 10 years for them all to come out.
Oh, my God.
But it's like one story. So
From Hell was actually done the same way.
Yeah, that was V for Vendetta, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's bizarro.
I mean,
the end of the day, I think it all depends on the story. Like there's no resolution definite point here. But no, that's cool. No, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's interesting. I mean, and as we see more of these Netflix shows come out, especially the Iron Man or Iron Fist, Luke Cage,
and the very poorly titled AKA Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
Who titled that?
Well, I can see why they did that.
Yeah, if you're a comic book reader, you look at it and go, that's kind of clever or interesting. Everybody else?
There was also a TV show starring Jessica Ritter, isn't that her name?
Kristen Ritter.
Kristen Ritter.
Don't Mind the Bee
and something 23.
Apartment 23. Yeah.
So, I don't know. As we see these shows come out, it'll be real interesting to see. I mean, how they. I mean, obviously, I'm sure they're all going to be built the same way as Daredevil. But at the end, it'll be. I don't know. It'll be fun. Yeah. It's going to be great. Like, I would love to see like one of these say, "Oh, this would have been better as a 13-hour movie or a series of 3 movies or something." Yeah. But yeah, I think. I don't know. I think that's. Like I said, we haven't. We didn't really come to a point, so I feel like I don't know how to end this because there's no definite answer to this.
Like I said, it's for this character and for this story, it seems to fit better than a movie would have. And that's why I like it better than any of the movies so far. So, again, your mileage may vary, and so might mine when I finish the next nine episodes.
Let's all wrap it up, and we'll see how we feel at that point.
Yeah,
even though,
the idea is that next week we'll have finished Daredevil, oh my God. And then we'll talk about it. So you guys may have noticed, you listeners out there, that we have everyone in studio and everyone has in the studio, in my basement, recording the podcast this week. Nick graciously drove, or was driven out here by his friend Jordan. To help us record this, because we did a very special episode, a very special series of recordings. Everything's very special. Yeah. So it's all new. Everything's all new. Ultimate.
All new.
All new. All Ultimate.
New 52. New 52. All new. Now.
.now. Yeah. No, this
dot
is
Journey to Now. Journey to Star Wars. Slash.
So, courtesy of Lucasfilm. So, so this today's been kind of long, so we're not actually going to do a wrap up, but look for the special episodes coming up in the near future. Nick, thank you again for coming out, and Jordan, thank you for driving him.
You.
And as always,
much
Paul and Nick, thank you guys for joining me.
Of course.
No this problem. Has been the I Read Comic Books podcast, and we will catch you very soon.
Bye.
You're keeping it.
Keep that. All right.
Thank you for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg, produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Onomonoguchi, Cold Electric, Explodey Man, and Infinity Shred. If you have any questions or would like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @DestroyTheCyb and on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And again, thank you for listening.